Hi, this is Jen Zaman, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, our show will first air a live interview of Lauren Bonds, legal director of the ACLU of Kansas, by host Craig Lubo. Lauren will be talking about the lawsuit the Kansas ACLU filed in early April that asked the court to compel the state to protect Kansas inmates from COVID-19 and to act quickly. The ACLU filed the class action lawsuit on behalf of people imperiled by dangerous conditions inside ill-equipped and overcrowded state prisons amid the raging COVID-19 pandemic. After the calendar, in the second half of our program, host Margot Patterson will interview Miriam Krinsky, founder and executive director of Fair and Just Prosecution. Fair and Just Prosecution brings together a network of leaders committed to promoting a justice system grounded in fairness, equity, compassion, and fiscal responsibility. She will talk about the need for early prison release because of the coronavirus pandemic. Miriam will discuss why prison release is important not only for the health of those housed in jails and prisons, but for the good of society. She has led calls to reduce the incarcerated population, and she says the changes taking place will be hard to reverse when the pandemic eventually ends. Stay tuned. We will air the 420 Drug War News at the end of our program. Let's listen now to Craig Lubo and Lauren Bonds.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa. Lauren, are you there?
Yeah, good morning, Craig. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? So what today is that we're going to talk about the lawsuit ACLU brought against the state of Kansas and the status of that. So let me just have you start out by giving us background on what this lawsuit was about.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is a lawsuit we filed after we got a number of complaints from folks who are currently incarcerated in the Kansas Department of Corrections facilities and also their concerned family members. We started getting reports in late March that there was just no adequate procedures and protocols in place to make sure that the virus was not spreading, to make sure that the virus was not coming into individual facilities. And also, you know, very significant concerns that there was going to be inadequate testing and treatment should the virus be able to infiltrate some of the facilities. And so after speaking with a number of folks who are currently incarcerated and their family members, we filed a class action habeas corpus petition with the Kansas Supreme Court alleging that the inadequacy of treatment and prevention protocols constituted a violation of our client's Eighth Amendment right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. And so the relief that we are requesting in this action is that the prisons depopulate to a certain extent to make sure that social distancing and physical distancing as recommended by the CDC are possible. We also have a couple of other additional requests for relief, including making sure that soap and other basic sanitation measures are available free of charge to all inmates. And so we filed this class action petition. I think that would have been back April 9th, a while ago at this point. And we originally had a hearing scheduled with the Kansas Supreme Court. After reviewing the full briefing of both parties, they transferred the case to Leavenworth County District Court, and that's currently where the case is pending right now.
All right. And why did they transfer it to Leavenworth? Is that where the suit started, or did you file it originally with the Supreme Court?
So we filed the case originally with the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, the Kansas Supreme Court didn't give us a ton of insight into their reasoning behind the transfer. However, Leavenworth is the county where Lansing Correctional Facility is located. That's where the majority of our clients are, And that's also where the virus has taken hold in the most significant ways, I think, in terms of the number of folks infected. I think it's, you know, over 100 staff and residents at this point have tested positive for COVID-19 at that facility. And so I think largely the reason for the transfer was for there to be additional fact-finding done by the district court. However, I would note that all of the case was transferred, not just the Lansing pieces of the case. So even though it's, you know, the Leavenworth County District Court is closest to Lansing, they're also considering claims from our clients who are located in Topeka and Ellsworth and other facilities throughout the state.
Okay. And what is currently being done to protect the inmates and staff?
You know, that's a really great question, Craig. I think there's not a lot of, if you ask our clients, and that's who we're talking to, not a lot of steps have been taken. You know, I think that there have been some protocols implemented and procedures implemented by KDOC to make sure that staff who are going in and out of the prisons are being tested and screened. I think there are some, you know, personal protective equipment that's been distributed, at least in certain parts of Lansing. However, you know, it was a little too late on some of those some of those calls. You know, those weren't implemented until April 10th or 11th. You know, long after the disease had already, you know, infiltrated the prison. So, but beyond kind of, you know, that, there's still, as far as we know, there's still, you know, no physical distancing being required. People are still sleeping and eating and moving with groups of 100 people where they're, you know, within inches of each other. So there's definitely been no protections put in place as far as that goes.
And if I'm not mistaken, most, if not all, of the inmates, unless they're in some kind of protective custody or special lockdown, they generally have at least two sharing each cell, don't they?
Yeah, and that's our understanding. I think just about all of our clients have cellmates. A number of them are in dorm setups where, you know, they're kind of in a open air space with, you know, close to 100 other inmates. So that's even more concerning where they're, you know, not only are they within a couple of feet of the person they're bunking, they share a bunk bed with, but also within a couple of inches of kind of the next bunk over.
Okay. And one of the things that I heard on one of the news broadcasts, and I don't know if I heard it right or not, that the inmates did not have hand sanitizer because it contains alcohol, and they won't give them hand sanitizer because of that?
That's correct. That's our understanding.
All right. So I can't imagine that an inmate would sit there and drink hand sanitizer, though. Another
doesn't seem
issue
like it'd be worth it,
relating, what was that?
Oh, I said, doesn't sound like it would be worth it, but
no. So another issue that I'm wondering about, if it's also going to be raised as part of the case, is due process violations. And specifically what I'm thinking of is, well, I'll give you an example with some of my clients as well as some of the other attorneys in Wyandotte County. We've got people who are having their hearings set over 2 or 3 months because of this pandemic. And the Kansas law of speedy trial doesn't officially begin to run until after the prelim. But if they're sitting there an extra 3 months waiting for the prelim because of the pandemic, is there some kind of due process violation that can be raised?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So that's a little bit beyond the purview of our case, just because all of our clients are, and all the people in KDOC facilities for the most part, are folks who have already been convicted and they're already serving their sentence. But, you know, for pretrial folks, that's a huge concern, that not only are there these delays in getting your hearing and getting your trial, but also a lot of the folks who are being forced to be incarcerated in pretrial detention centers and jails, they should be innocent until, proven guilty. They are, in there a lot of times because they can't afford bail. And so there's a whole host of additional constitutional concerns with pretrial detainees, due process being one of them for sure.
All right. And in terms of the case being transferred back to Leavenworth County, has any hearings been set on that yet?
So there hasn't been a hearing set. We do have a, somewhat somewhat detailed briefing schedule at this point. Kansas Department of Corrections and wardens who were named in the petition had until Friday to file their answer. It's our understanding that that got filed. I think it just hasn't been docketed yet. And so I think kind of the next steps for whether there will be a hearing and when that will be scheduled, we should have more information about in the next couple of days.
All right. And what's being done in an important part of the inmate's progress is to maintain contact with the outside, specifically visitation with family. Has that been cut off completely, the visitation, or are they finding ways to allow it and still keep them safe?
Yeah, so physical visitation has been completely cut off, as far as I know. I do know that there's been additional opportunities for video visitation and phone calls for family, and that some of the requirements, payment requirements, have been reduced or lessened in order to make sure that people are still able to see their family over video, at least. So that it's our understanding that there are still electronic forms of visitation that are continuing at KDOC facilities. However, I would just note that things have been in such chaos at the Lansing facility due to the number of staff who are who have been sick and have had to call out and the shortages there, that I do know that there's been some issues in terms of folks being able to get in contact with their family members due to that element of the virus right now.
Yes, they do a video call with the family member. Would they still go to the prison and be there someplace where they would be on video? Or can they do this from home? Or
I think these video calls are taking place remotely, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But I'm fairly certain.
All right. And what about these issues being raised in lawsuits at other chapters of the ACLU are filing in other states too?
Yeah, so I think about 40 states have, then these aren't all, just by the ACLU, but I think in about 40 different states, or maybe 41 at this point, there have been actions to reduce the number of folks who are currently incarcerated in order to reduce the spread of the pandemic, whether that be in jails or prisons. And so this is definitely something that there's a lot of precedent for, I would say.
And so in reviewing the inmates, what is the process or timeline that they're following on that to review who they might be able to release early?
That's a great question. We, have heard kind of rumblings that the governor, with the assistance of Secretary Zamuda, is reviewing certain inmates and is, trying to put together a preliminary list of folks that they think should be eligible for release. I'm not sure kind of what the timeline is for that, or even kind of what factors they're considering. The governor has mentioned different things in her press conferences. One of them is, one of the factors that seems to be under consideration is how much time is left on an individual sentence. And so, that's definitely a class of folks that we've identified in our litigation that we think should be expedited for release. But it's still unclear to us whether that's going to happen and kind of what, the criteria are going to be. We're hopeful that it does, though.
All in a place where, like Lansing, where they have a huge population that is maximum security, is there any way that you've identified or any way possible that you can suggest that they can institute social distancing with the number of inmates they have?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think one of the things about Lansing, they're, you know, they have a brand new facility, as many people know, that whether you were in favor of the amount of money spent on that or not, there is a new facility that I think is would make physical distancing a more viable option, even for, you know, high security individuals and populations, particularly if less staff had to be devoted to the folks who are currently in lower level security settings, folks that are eligible for release relatively soon, folks who are, you know, currently serving sentences for low level offenses. So I think to the extent the kind of pressure on the system can be taken off from those groups of people either being released or paroled, I think that would make managing maximum security individuals much more feasible for a place like Lansing. And we're, you know, I think that's already what they're trying to do in terms of using their new facility. It's just a matter of making sure there's sufficient staff and also, you know, sufficient space that they could use kind of some of these other spaces that are currently housing low-level offenders and folks who are almost done with their sentence.
And you referred to the new facility. Did that completely replace the old facility, or are they still using that as well?
My understanding is both the new and old facility are being used currently. I don't know if that's just a consequence of the transition being ongoing to the new facility or not, but it's my understanding that both that buildings and both facilities are being used currently.
All right. And can you tell us what some of the arguments, legal arguments, are being raised in the brief by on both sides of the issue?
Sure. Yeah. So I think, you know, I mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation, but, you know, our main merit argument here is that, you know, exposing someone to an infectious disease when you don't have to constitutes a violation of the Eighth Amendment. That's not a radical or new idea. That's pretty well established by the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court and Kansas Supreme Court. And a number of courts have recognized that, you know, failure to implement reasonable protocols to protect against, you know, virus transmissions or other or transmissions of other kinds of diseases or bacteria is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. So that's kind of the square argument that we're making. And I think on the other side, you know, the Department of Corrections is saying, you know, we're doing everything we can. From our view, that's not a sufficient answer, and that's not a sufficient defense to an Eighth Amendment violation. But that's kind of the two sides of the coin here. I would note that the Department of Corrections is raising a number of other kind of procedural defenses to the case, including that our clients haven't, you know, sufficiently exhausted their administrative remedies, things like that. But we feel like we have, you know, sufficient responses to that as well.
If the other side prevails on the exhaustion of remedies argument, what are some of the administrative remedies that they could pursue then?
I think that's kind of our main rebuttal is that this, you know, situation isn't amenable to administrative grievance process, right? I mean, and there's a number of Kansas court cases that recognize that, that, you know, inadequate and overcrowded jail conditions isn't something that a, you know, warden can say, oh, we'll just change this and you'll be good. And so that's essentially our response is that there isn't an actual administrative remedy available. And so I think that's why the well-recognized legal exception applies to that exhaustion requirement.
Is there a difference between what's being done between different prisons, or is it pretty much the same through all the prisons?
We're seeing pretty consistent responses throughout the prisons. Obviously, certain prisons are have been, you know, hit with more confirmed cases than others. Namely, Lansing is you know, much worse than anywhere else. And then we also have, you know, confirmed cases in both Topeka and the Wichita Work Facility. However, I would say in terms of preventative precautions, we're seeing pretty much the same thing across the state, and that's, you know, lack of physical distancing, lack of, you know, soap and hand sanitizer being available, lack of sanitation, lack of other, you know, kind of sanitation measures being available to inmates, and that's pretty consistent regardless of what facility folks are in.
Are they being given face masks to wear?
So it's my understanding that face masks have only been made available in Lansing. I don't believe they've been made available in any other facility at this point.
All right. So we just have about a minute or two left. Is there anything that I've left out that you think listeners would want to know about this?
No, I don't think so. I would just note that, you know, a number of our clients and the, you know, large group of the folks that we're asking be released are people who are medically vulnerable. And by that, I mean they are, you know, particularly susceptible to either very severe symptoms if they contract the virus or even death. And so I would just note that, you know, what we're requesting is not, you know, just more comfort for individual inmates. We're trying to make sure that, you know, this doesn't become an issue of life or death for some people. And so that's really the you know, main motivation for our case right now.
The last question I thought of, too, is I know right now the lawsuit's against the state for the state prisons. If you prevail on this, would there be applicability or a separate lawsuit filed against them in the counties relating to the county jails?
So I think that, you know, that path of litigation is available regardless of what happens in our particular case and in the case against the state. Like I said, I think it's pretty well established under the Eighth Amendment and under the Kansas Bill of Rights, Section 9 of the Kansas Bill of Rights, that you have a right to be free from unnecessary infection of a virus or disease. And so I think there'd be nothing that we wouldn't really necessarily need to wait for a good decision in this case to pursue something against the county.
All right. And I think we're about out of time. For those who just joined us, I've been talking to Lauren Bonds, who is the legal director at ACLU. We've been talking about a lawsuit pending in the state courts against the state to essentially force them to protect the inmates from the coronavirus. And Lauren has been with ACLU for about 3 years now. So I want to thank you, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me on, Craig.
Okay, I will turn it back to Keith now.
Support for KKFI comes from Meshuggah Bagels, open for carryout at all four locations with online ordering at meshuggahbagels.com. 1208 West 39th Street in KC Mo, 7096 West 105th in Overland Park, 205 South Stewart Road in Liberty, Missouri, and 40 East 13th Street in the Power and Light District. Bagels, schmears, and sandwiches all available for carryout or curbside service is available for online orders by pulling up and honking your horn. Online ordering is at meshuggahbagels.com.
This week on The Bioneers.
The labor for justice lasts a lifetime. There is no end to the labor. But I have learned that if we labor in love, love for others, love for our opponents, and love for ourselves, then we will last.
Civil rights activist, lawyer, and filmmaker Valerie Kaur shares her vision for revolutionary love on Bioneers Radio.
Every Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. right here on your community radio station, KKFI.
Now the calendar for the week of April 27th. In compliance with the local instruction, all live meetings are suspended until the all-clear is given by the mayor. All Cory's network activities are canceled. When they resume normal activities, we will pass them on to you. Moore Square asks us to join one of their phone banks to check in on neighbors in Kansas and Missouri. Phone banks are on Tuesday, April 28th from 9 a.m. until noon, or Thursday, April 30th from 4 to 7 p.m. Training is provided. If you have questions, you may contact Gary at moresquare.org or call 913-250-7330. Tuesday, April 28th, noon Eastern Time, will be a Facebook and Twitter live event discussion with Stacey Abrams, politician, sponsored by Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. RSVP at Moms Demand Action on Facebook. Thursday, April 30th, at 7 to 10 p.m., the Sexual Trauma and Abuse Care Center invites you to Take Back the Night, an annual solidarity event for survivors of trauma and abuse and those who want to take a stand against rape culture. Due to the social distancing guidelines set in place because of the coronavirus outbreak, they've adjusted to an online format instead of the traditional rally. There will be online content available with support from local musicians and community members. They ask the community to join in lighting a candle at 8 p.m. in solidarity and support for survivors. There's an online candidate forum of Missouri candidates on Thursday, April 30, 6 to 8 p.m., sponsored by Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus. You can hear Missouri candidates before online voting, which begins May 1st to May 7th. See the Zoom invitation at Indivisible KC. Empower Missouri Smart Sentencing Coalition is comprised of organizations and individuals all working toward a Missouri that's smart on crime instead of tough on crime. All are welcome to join the coalition. Join the call this week, Friday, May 1st, 11 a.m., if you're able. More information at empowermissouri.org. Third annual Word to Ya Mother Poetry Slam and Music Showcase hosted by Real Justice Network will be Friday, May 1st from 7 to 8:30 p.m. This is a Facebook Live event raising funds to bail mamas out of jail and offer support services to keep them out. See on Facebook. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. Please take care of yourself and others. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank all our volunteers. Please listen next week. Our show will feature host Elisa Breitenbach and her guests discuss the Curtis Scott Hansen case.
I'm Margot Patterson, and this is the Jaws of Justice. Fair and Just Prosecution is a fairly new organization founded 3.5 years ago to work with elected prosecutors to promote a fairer, more compassionate, and responsible justice system. Fair and Just Prosecution has a variety of issues it's concerned with, but one of the major issues it's focused on right now is the need for early release of prisoners because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here to talk to us today about that is Miriam Krinsky, founder and executive director of Fair and Just Prosecution. She has extensive experience working for law enforcement reform and for the improvement of jail conditions and prison facilities, and she previously served for 15 years as a federal prosecutor, both in Los Angeles and in the Mid-Atlantic region. Miriam Krinsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Margot. Happy to be on.
Well, let's begin with a conversation about why you and others at Fair and Just Prosecution think it is so important that releasing prisoners, to release prisoners, not only for those who are housed in prison and who work in prison, but for the entire society. What's the argument you all are making?
Well, I think in this moment of crisis, we have to recognize that the spread of this life-threatening virus in our prisons and jails is a human tragedy, and it's a tragedy that is impacting not just those in these densely populated living circumstances where you simply can't abide by safe distancing or CDC guidelines, but it's also a ticking time bomb for our entire community. When this infection, we know from what we've seen, gets into these facilities, it spreads like wildfire. We've seen it in the DC jails spread at a rate that is 14 times that of the broader community. We've seen it at a place like Rikers Island in New York go from one case to over 200 cases in a space of a matter of just under 2 weeks. And just last week, we saw the number of individuals in prisons and jails that have been infected by the virus triple in number. So because of the fact that individuals who work in the jails come and go and return to their families and their loved ones and their community at large, we know that this virus, if we don't reduce the dense population in these facilities, isn't simply going to threaten those on the inside, but this is a public safety and public health issue for our entire community, given the fact that these facilities are not closed off from our society and community at large. And what comes in and spreads within is going to then be brought back to the community as well.
Well, I imagine that some people listening might respond that releasing prisoners early may also pose a danger to society. How does one go about decarcerating prisoners safely and responsibly? Who should be released? What should the criteria be?
Well, I think that we've already seen that it can be done. And I think, you know, as your question presupposed, it does need to be done responsibly, and it can be done responsibly. We need to be looking at those individuals who are elderly, who, as we know, in vast numbers in our current custodial facilities are over the age of 55 or 60, who are medically vulnerable, who are near the end of their sentence, or who have been serving long prison terms and have aged out of crime, which data tells us is exactly what happens over the decades. People are not 30 or 40 or 20 years later the individuals that they were at the time that we incarcerated them. And for those populations, we need to be asking ourselves whether releasing them would pose a serious risk to the safety, public safety of others. And if the answer to that is no, then they should be returning home. Because if we maintain the status quo, a recent report from the ACLU tells us that we could be threatening as many as 100,000 additional lives if the status quo remains in place and these conditions and this, you know, wildfire spread of the virus is allowed to remain over the course of the next coming weeks and months within our prisons and jails.
Well, let me ask you that point about elderly prisoners, because I was very surprised to read on your website that the percentage of people in prison over the age of 55 more than tripled between 2000 and 2016, and that there are something like 150,000 people in that older age bracket. Why did that percentage triple between 2000 and 2016?
Well, I think in many ways, you know, it's sort of the unfortunate payback of a period of time when I myself was a prosecutor in the 80s and the 90s. As we went through that period of time when tough on crime and really ramping up the numbers of individuals who are coming into our justice system in a way that no other country in the world was doing, we saw an increase in our prison population that now has found itself with individuals, as you referenced, who have been there a long time. Many of them were incarcerated based on mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses, where our sentences, again, are unparalleled as we look around the globe. And many of them have been there for for years on end and really posed no danger to the community if we were to return them home to their families, and simply instead are sitting there at great vulnerability to this virus, and who should not be serving out, as this virus spreads through those facilities, a de facto death sentence by virtue of their vulnerability and by virtue of the consequences if they're infected with this virus.
Well, what's been the response so far of correctional facilities to the coronavirus?
Well, I think, you know, they're largely struggling because they recognize that in places where people are literally sleeping on top of each other, where individuals are housed in dorms that often have 70, 80, 90, 100 people in a single room, where air circulation is not particularly good, where hand sanitizer is contraband by virtue of the alcohol content, and where people are showering and eating in common rooms and maybe have a bar of soap for the entire week. You know, given those circumstances, these facilities are particularly ill-equipped to deal with what's hitting them. It's, you know, essentially like a cruise ship, but exponentially greater in terms of the dangers that it poses. And so, you know, they're doing their best, but they're perhaps taking, you know, a cataclysmic situation and simply doing their best to find its way toward just a bad situation. And by virtue of that, we are seeing the virus now start to come into facilities and places like a facility in Arkansas or in Marion, Ohio, where now in Arkansas, over 80% of the individuals in that facility have taken ill, and where the vast majority are going to be at grave risk. And as they become infected by people from the outside bringing the virus in turn, they're going to be infecting those who weren't ill, who work in the facilities, and then bring that virus back to their families. So again, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that this is a public health risk that should really be of great concern to everyone, not simply those with loved ones who are housed in these facilities.
Well, on April 3rd, Attorney General William Barr issued a letter urging the Federal Bureau of Prisons to maximize the release of prisoners in federal facilities. I've read that about 0.5% of prisoners in those facilities have been released. What's the holdup, and are state prisons doing any better?
Well, I think, you know, as you indicated, the clock is running, and we don't have a lot of time on our hands in dealing with this. And the federal response has been just painfully slow, and we have to do better. The holdup has been by virtue of some, you know, very complicated and unwieldy processes that the Attorney General put in place, that really don't recognize the need to take a long, hard look at the classes of people who are medically vulnerable, who are elderly, who are near the end of the sentence, and who can safely return to the community. It's put in place a process where, in addition, the Attorney General has ordered that anyone even potentially subject to release is being held in those facilities in quarantine for 14 days rather than allowing those individuals to return home or to go to some other place outside of the facility for a 14-day quarantine. So it's been moving at a glacial pace in the federal system. And for the state and local systems, we are seeing places where there's been a very different willingness to acknowledge the ticking time bomb that awaits them. We've seen facilities in Cleveland and in San Antonio and San Francisco where they've been able to reduce the population by 50% or more We've seen the release ordered in California of 3,500 prisoners. We've seen New Jersey order 1,000 individuals released. Kentucky, the governor has ordered the commutation of around 1,000 prisoner sentences. So we know that where there's a will, there's a way to make it happen. And there are prosecutors around the country who are very much in favor of these sorts of strategies because they realize that the safety and health of their community depends on it. And I think they also realize that, you know, in these times of crisis, our moral compass and our moral humanity is defined by what we do and how we do it. And every person in these facilities is somebody's loved one. They're someone's mother or father or sibling or son or daughter. And while they've made mistakes and they should be held accountable for those mistakes, we shouldn't be willing to allow them to die by virtue of those mistakes. And we have to be treating them in a way that's going to be defining who we are as a society and how we deal with this kind of crisis in a way that is right by them and right by our entire community.
I'm Margo Patterson, and this is the Jaws of Justice. And if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Miriam Krinsky, founder and executive director of Fair and Just Prosecution. Well, it seems like there are a lot of moving parts to this problem because in addition to the United States having 2.3 million prisoners, there are young prisoners, juveniles, 48,000 children are held in prisons, and there are 10.6 million times a year people cycling through American jails, even if only for a few hours. Where do you start with the problem, or what do you think is the right way to start with the problem? Do you start with trying to cut down people's time in jail, or just doing all of these simultaneously?
Well, I think it has to be a multifaceted approach because this problem is too dire, and the threat is not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when it reaches crisis proportions, and we're very close to that. So I think you have to first and foremost look at the front door of the justice system and recognize, as prosecutors are doing around the country and as law enforcement leaders are doing in some communities, that in this moment, who we bring into the justice system has to be very selective, and that we really shouldn't be bringing individuals into our system or cycling them through our jails, as you alluded to earlier, Margo, if they're committing things like drug possession or smoking marijuana in the park or committing technical violations of probation or parole. This is a moment in time where those sorts of offenses that just don't pose a danger to our community should not be a priority for our justice system. And so we're seeing prosecutors like Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore and Dan Satterberg in Seattle and Parissa Tafti in Arlington, Virginia, and others around the country making smart choices and working with law enforcement leaders like the police commissioner in Cook County in Chicago is doing to essentially make clear that those kinds of lower-level offenses are simply no longer in this moment, in this time that is so precarious, going to be brought into the justice system in the first instance. I think second of all, we need to look at those individuals who are incarcerated, who are awaiting trial on bond, and if they're there simply because they can't afford cash bail, they can't afford to buy their way out, we have to be releasing them the way our Chief Justice and the Judicial Council in California has ordered, that those individuals who are being held just because they can't pay a monetary payment should be allowed, unless there's a showing that they pose a serious risk to the community, to return home, just as individuals who are in prisons serving their sentences who can safely return home should be identified and released home if there's a way to do so without endangering the safety of the community.
Well, you mentioned some prosecutors who are responding to the crisis. And obviously, the prosecutors in your organization support this call. But prosecutors make their living by putting people in jail. Do you think most prosecutors are on board with this? Or how typical is your organization of of the mentality of prosecutors across the country today?
Well, I think the view that's embraced by the prosecutors we work with, who are growing in number, who are from coast to coast, urban and rural areas, and cut through, you know, all political ideologies, is starting to become a new normal. You know, I think even before this pandemic hit, we were starting to see more and more voters and communities around the country embrace the view when going to the polls and voting for the individual who's going to serve as their district attorney or elected chief prosecutor, that our justice system has grown too large, that we need to shrink the size of the system, that we should no longer be willing to accept the starting point that the U.S. is an international outlier in the world and incarcerates more individuals than any other country in the globe. And so I think we've seen more communities grow tired with the tough on crime approach and starting point that simply wasn't serving our communities and that was coming at great cost, great fiscal cost and great human cost to individuals as well as our communities at large. And so I think we've started to see, even before this, a shifting paradigm and that growing new normal taking hold in the field of prosecution. And I think that has been reflected in the response to this pandemic. And certainly the individuals that we work with very quickly embraced and joined on to a statement that over 30 elected prosecutors issued at the start of this pandemic that agreed to a set of principles and a starting point that looked to address that narrowing of the front door, release of individuals to the extent possible and when safely, when it can be safely done, and the humane treatment of those who remain incarcerated. And I think that those approaches are starting to spread around the country, because even those who in the past have not necessarily subscribed to the sorts of principles that the group we work with embraces, I think they're realizing that the harm to their community is simply too great a cost to pay, and that we can't sit idly by and do nothing and allow the status quo that we've worked with for too many decades remain in place while we watch people die in large numbers.
Well, does your organization have any idea or any approximate number of how many prisoners you all think could be released?
Well, you know, I think that it's hard to say a specific number, but I think what we can say is that if you look at jail facilities that have reduced their populations to 50% or more, we see examples that model the fact that this can be done, that we can depopulate at great numbers. I think when we look to other countries who have started at an incarceration rate that is dramatically lower than the United States, I think when we look to countries that have reduced prisoners in numbers that greatly exceed that in our country, and when we look at the recent report I referenced earlier from the ACLU that really should be a warning bell for all of us, that makes clear that if we don't act in ways different than how we've responded up until now, 100,000 more lives are at stake. We have to be willing to subscribe to the view that doing more is a mandate, and we owe it to not simply those inside, but we owe it to our entire community to listen to that wake-up call and, you know, and to be spurred into action.
Well, I certainly understand that thousands of prisoners probably could be released. Do you think that number could be as much as hundreds of thousands?
I think it probably could. I mean, we have 2.3 million people in our prisons and jails in the United States. And as you referenced earlier, close to 50,000 of them are children. Some of them are as young as 8 years old. Is this really who we want to be? You know, do we really believe that we should be keeping young people or people in their 70s and 80s in these facilities and leave them, you know, to become ill alone, cut off from family and loved ones? And again, we're not suggesting that this should be done in a way that endangers our community. And we're not seeing that danger posed. You know, we are finding ourselves at a time where even before this pandemic, crime was at an all-time low. And crime has dropped further in the wake of the pandemic. We can look to communities like San Francisco, where they have released over 50% of the people in their jails. And crime has not gone up as a result. We know that we have thousands of people in our prisons and jails based on crimes that they committed for narcotics offenses years ago. And we have to ask ourselves, why have we been doing this for so long in a way that no other nation has done? Why do we sentence people and remove them from the community for 30 or 40 or life terms when other countries recognize that second chances are warranted? And we do have to hold people accountable, and we do have to bear in mind the needs and safety of our community. But I don't think it has to be done the way our country has been doing this for decades. And maybe now is a time when this wake-up call can allow us to extend our vision beyond our borders to how others have done it and learn something from that.
Well, I want to ask you a question about that. But first, let me just ask you quickly, insofar as there is resistance to releasing prisoners during this pandemic, where is it coming from and why?
Well, you know, I think some of it has come, as you referenced earlier, from federal leaders who seem to want to return us to the tough-on-crime era of the 80s and 90s, and who unfortunately over the past few years have been resurrecting a kind of fear-driven narrative that it doesn't align with crime data or statistics or what the best criminology thinkers in the nation tell us. Some of it has come from individuals who listen to that narrative and who are moved by fear or perhaps, you know, biases that that cause them to believe the worst in others. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate, but I think we have to be driven by data and facts and what we can learn from these years of having done things in a certain way and having spent billions of dollars on building up mass incarcerations and prisons and jails that we spent a lot of money on at the expense of investing in prevention and treatment other sorts of strategies.
Well, let me just jump in here. Are correctional facilities themselves, are they resistant to decarcerating prisoners, or are they behind this, or is it a kind of mixed response that you see?
I think it's been a bit mixed. I mean, I do think that there are some correctional facilities and even some privately run correctional facilities who profit off of the way we've been doing things. But we've also seen correctional unions fully aware of the fact that this danger, this pandemic, is a threat to their lives as well. So we have seen a lot of correctional unions speak up and watching their personnel take ill recognize that we have to do something and that continuing along this path is not one that aligns with their own self-interest either.
Miriam, this is our last question. you have on your website a discussion of how the United States compares with Germany in terms of very different approaches to crime. Germany has been decarcerating people for decades, a much lower rate of incarceration. Very briefly, could you say what Germany does that the United States could learn from? And we have only 30 seconds.
Sure. So I would encourage people to look at our issue brief on this. Germany is in a far different starting point in regard to who gets brought into the justice system and for how long. They don't bring young people in at the same rate we do. And when they impose sentences, a 15-year sentence would be really the high end of what they believe to be an appropriate period of time to remove somebody from the community.
Miriam?
And their conditions.
I am so sorry. We have to cut it off there, but thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking to Miriam Krinsky of Fair and Just Prosecution. Thank you, Miriam.
It's the 420 Drug War News. One of our guests on last week's Cultural Baggage Show was David Duffield of Houston Harm Reduction Alliance.
And so we're looking at trying to get more hepatitis A and B, which is really rampant in Houston. A, by the way, it's easily transmitted. And it's the same thing. You got to clean your hands, just like COVID. Clean your hands. There's other guidelines that I can go over with you that we're kind of following when it comes to outreach. But
Please, David, share those. This is a message for the folks out there that are still using.
Yeah. So the best thing is minimize your need to share supplies. If you're sharing bongs or pipes or joints or nasal straws, you have to be careful. You have to try to not share and do that. You have to practice harm reduction with your supplies. Wipe down the mouthpieces with alcohol swab before sharing, or use separate mouthpieces. Put using, smoking, and snorting injection equipment into bio buckets, or people who use like plastic Tide or something like that. Throw that stuff in there. We'll pick it up from you. Just give us a call. You can call our website or our Facebook page, and we'll come pick up the stuff. We got rid of 100,000 used syringes this month alone, which is that we had picked up over 6 months in Houston. So we're real proud of that.
David, share that phone number. Share that website right now.
Please. Okay, so the website is Houston Harm Reduction Alliance.com. And the same thing for our Facebook page is Houston Harm Reduction Alliance. And our phone number at our office that you can leave a message for us is 832-623-7074. Let us know. We'll come pick up your stuff, man. And we're doing deliveries. So, Dean, we're doing deliveries. If anybody calls or something, we'll do deliveries. We protect our outreach worker. Casey's doing them. He's been on it like crazy, doing a good job. We maintain a lot of our stuff is due delivery and drop-off type stuff, and we maintain that. And then we have our own ways to protect ourselves as we collect used syringes. But we're giving out clean syringes, Narcan, naloxone, fentanyl strips and stuff. We've been sharing our fentanyl strips with the University of Texas, that the HEROES program, that does a lot of good work about it, because they know that a lot of people will be coming off Suboxone during this time, that they'll be back on the streets. So we're trying to make sure they check their dope for fentanyl. We're trying to get the fentanyl strip to the dealers as best we can, but we're still picking up. So if you want us to come and drop some syringes off, all you have to do is give us a call and we'll come to you. We just can't meet you on the street right now.
Again, that was David Duffield of Houston Harm Reduction Alliance, and I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.